Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Hello, and thank you for joining us for the February 2, 2022 reading of the Environment Program. This is Karen Wheeler, and today we will be reading the following main articles. Our first two articles are from the science section of the New York Times. Groundhogs Emerge from the Scientific Shadows, written by Brandon Keem, and Two Simple Tricks That Help Owls Stay in Their New Homes, written by Matt Kaplan. Living in a bubble. Did this failed 90s experiment predict the future? Written by Rosie Frost for the Environment Desk at Euronews. And of course, if we have time, following up with miscellaneous articles. First up, Groundhogs Emerge from the Scientific Shadows. New research aims to shed light on the social habits of the popular but often misunderstood animal. Written by Brandon Keem. Groundhog Day may be a tongue-in-cheek holiday, but it remains the one day earmarked in the United States for an animal, Marmota monax, the largest and most widely distributed of the marmot genus, found munching on flowering plants, or at this time of year snuggling underground, from Alabama to Alaska. Yet, for all their cultural prominence, groundhogs remain, as it were, in a bit of a shadow. Relatively little is known about their social life. They're thought of as solitary, which is not precisely wrong, but neither is it entirely accurate. "These guys are much more social than we thought," said Christine Maher, a behavioral ecologist at the University of Southern Maine, and one of the few scientists to study groundhog behavior. Dr. Maher arrived in Maine in 1998 with a keen interest in animal sociality. Marmots, a genus spanning 15 species of varying sociality, including alpine marmots living in multi-generational family groups, a semi-social yellow-bellied marmots, and ostensibly antisocial groundhogs, were a natural subject. She found an ideal study site at the Gilsland Farm Audubon Center, a 65-acre sanctuary of rolling meadows and forests on the coast of Falmouth, Maine. There, she has tagged no fewer than 513 groundhogs, following their fates and their relationships in fine-grained detail. The resulting family trees and territorial maps, along with the records of their interactions and daily activities, are singular. "Nobody looked at them over time as individuals," Dr. Maher said. Gilsland's groundhogs won't emerge until late February, but one morning last summer, Dr. Maher was out setting peanut butter-baited live traps around a shrub-hidden burrow beside the visitor center. The peanut butter soon proved irresistible. The trap afforded a rare up-close view of a groundhog, sleekly sturdy, with small, serious eyes, delicate whiskers, and a fur that shaded from auburn on her broad chest to a melange of chestnut, straw, and russet across the rest of her body. One round ear bore a tiny bronze tag inscribed with the number 580. "This is Torch," said Dr. Maher, who names each of her study subjects. Torch was a first-time mother. Dr. Maher deftly transferred her to a thick bag to allow for safe weighing. She also took a hair sample for later DNA analysis and measured how much Torch wriggled during the several 30-second intervals, a simple test of personality. After returning Torch, irritated but unharmed, to her burrow, Dr. Maher started a circuit of Gilsland. She checked out several still-empty traps for Barnadette, who was raising her pups beneath an old barn. Near the barn was a sprawling community garden and the smorgasbord of their compost pile. As anyone whose vegetable garden is visited by groundhogs can attest, the arrangement created a certain tension. Charles Kaufman, one of the garden's coordinators, acknowledged that conflicts with gardeners had occurred, but resolved peacefully. Among their peacekeeping tools are floppy fences that groundhogs struggle to climb. Audubon is for the preservation and appreciation of the natural world, Mr. Kaufman said. We feel bound to live within that perspective and philosophy. Also, he adds, groundhog pups are just the cutest things in the world. Along a path leading from the gardens into a meadow, Dr. Maher spotted a groundhog. Through her scope, she identified Athos, a yearling and a sibling to Porthos and Aramis. She named them after the Three Musketeers, a trick to help her remember them, but it was also fitting. A few days prior, she had observed them hanging out together at the burrow where they were born. Such interactions belie the species' solitary reputation, and conventional wisdom holds that juvenile groundhogs leave home to seek new territories just a few months after they're born. At Gilsland, Dr. Maher has found that roughly half the juveniles remain there for a full year in the territory of their birth. When they finally depart, they often stay nearby. It depends on whether they can strike an agreement with their mother, Dr. Maher said. Some moms will do that, others won't. Mothers may even bequeath territories to their daughters. Dr. Maher suspected that Athos' mom had left Athos the family burrow. As groundhogs mature, their interactions become less amicable. The Three Musketeers most likely would not lounge together for much longer. But neither are they entirely antagonistic. Dr. Maher has found her groundhogs to be friendlier to relatives than to unrelated individuals. The result is a community of related groundhogs whose territories overlap. Some individuals do venture further afield or arrive from afar, which helps keep the gene pool fresh. But a kinship-based structure remains. Gilsland Farms groundhogs are living in something like a loose-knit clan, its members keeping their distance but still crossing paths and maintaining relations. You have these whole networks of sisters living together, aunts, cousins, extending outward, Dr. Maher said. Daniel Bloomstein, an evolutionary biologist at the University of California, Los Angeles, who leads a long-term study of yellow-bellied marmots at Rocky Mountain Biological Laboratory, said that Dr. Maher's data was, quote, increasing understanding of the benefits of subtle social relationships. He added, she's allowing us to appreciate the nuanced complexity of less in-your-face social relationships. A question is whether the patterns Dr. Maher sees at Gilsland Farm are common in other groundhog populations. Behaviors may vary depending on local circumstance, she said. Gilsland Farm's groundhogs live on what amounts to a habitat island. To the west is an impassable estuary. To the east, a dangerous highway. North and south are suburban neighborhoods rich in potential habitat, but bristling with unwelcoming homeowners. They're seen as varmints, Dr. Maher said of the groundhogs. People don't seem to give them much thought. When young groundhogs do leave Gilsland Farm, they tend to end up run over or shot. So there are advantages to staying home if there is enough food. There are also mutual benefits. For example, a whistle of alarm occasioned by an approaching fox would be heard by all nearby. From the bird's-eye vantage of evolution, the genes of somewhat social groundhogs spread more readily than more solitary ones, and Dr. Maher thinks it may represent a return to something like an ancestral state. Before European colonization, groundhogs would have lived in clearings created by fires, storms, beaver activity, and indigenous practices, separated by inhospitable forests. They had to live closer together, so they were more tolerant of each other and more social, she said. When Europeans cleared all that forest, they increased the amount of habitat available for groundhogs. Perhaps they became less social because they could spread out. The neighborhoods don't have to be dangerous, though, Dr. Maher hopes a deeper appreciation of groundhog sociality may help people become more sympathetic and even graciously share the suburban landscape with them, the way the Gilsland farm gardeners do. People don't usually have that insight into the way they live, said John Griffin, director of urban wildlife programs at the Humane Society of the United States. In his own work, Mr. Griffin often encounters a sense of groundhogs as intruders. He thinks a lack of familiarity leads to intolerance or an exaggerated sense of risk. Appreciating that animals have social lives can change how they're perceived, Mr. Griffin said. I don't know how to quantify it, but I think it's valuable, he said. Tolerance would benefit more than groundhogs. Their digging helps aerate and enrich soil, Dr. Maher said, and many other creatures use their burrows and may even create hot spots of local biodiversity. Athos, at least, would be spared the suburban gauntlet. The fact that she hasn't left yet makes me think she'll stick around, Dr. Maher said. Athos moved slowly along the path, eating the clover and dandelions that would sustain her through the coming winter. Every so often, she stood on two legs and looked around. Dr. Maher noted her activities on a handheld computer. Then, when an approaching pedestrian sent Athos scurrying into the tall grass, Dr. Maher explained her system. Well, I just key in two-letter codes for their behavior, she said. Feed, walk, alert, run, groom, dig occasionally. They don't have a huge repertoire. She sounded slightly self-conscious about this. Passers-by, she says, are sometimes amused that she spends so much time watching seemingly boring creatures. With a rustle, Athos returned to the path. Oh, there she is! Dr. Maher exclaimed, the enthusiasm in her voice suggesting that, after all these years, she still finds groundhogs quite interesting indeed. Two simple tricks that help owls stay in their new homes. A study shows that there is a way to successfully transplant burrowing owls to new habitats when developers build over their homes. Written by Matt Kaplan. As far as wild animals go, the western burrowing owl is a tolerant neighbor to humans. When new houses and roads are built next to the tunnels they call home, these owls put up with the noise and carrying on, hunting the insects and rodents that they eat. But the owls are increasingly on a collision course with humanity. Developers are always looking for more land on which to build, and in places like Southern California. That means moving into the owls' habitats. To date, most builders have displaced owls by collapsing their burrows, forcing them to find a new place to live nearby. Even so, in heavily urbanized environments, the birds often have nowhere to go, putting the species' future at risk. As a result, wildlife officials working with developers are increasingly collecting and transplanting the owls to distant new areas that conservationists think will meet their needs. Evidence that this technique works has been thin, though. New research just published on January 27, 2022 in the journal Animal Conservation shows it can be very effective if the birds are tricked into believing there are already other burrowing owls near where they're transplanted. Ronald Swaysgood of the San Diego Zoo Wildlife Alliance, a member of the research team that produced the report, knew that developers were setting aside land for displaced birds, but noted that there was little follow-up work on how the owls were doing. "Nobody had any idea if these mitigation measures were even working," he said. Aware that the birds were being considered for classification as endangered in California, Dr. Swaysgood was keen to intervene. He and other conservationists felt that nothing was going to stop the property development, which included new solar energy farms. Given the complex situation, he and his team collaborated with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to run an experiment with owls that were on land to be bulldozed in the greater San Diego area. To understand whether the owl transplants were effective, researchers set up special doors on the burrows of the colonies that allowed the owls to leave, but not return. Once the owls were out, all 44 were collected and moved to a new location that already had burrows for them. To help these translocated owls cope, they were kept in acclimation enclosures for 30 days before being released. Of this group, half were exposed to just a bit of trickery. Researchers knew from previous work with other species, such as black rhinos, vultures, and kangaroo rats, that animals are more likely to settle when led to believe that members of their kind are nearby. With this in mind, for half of the birds, the team splattered non-toxic white latex paint on the rocks around burrows in the new location that looked like bird poop. They did this because burrowing owls have a tendency to defecate near burrow entrances, and this technique makes the sites look inhabited. To further support this illusion, an outdoor speaker was set up at these sites to periodically play burrowing owl calls during the week before the animals were released from their acclimation enclosures and during the following week. All of this ecological duplicity paid off. The 22 birds translocated to sites with white paint and calls quickly settled in, while the other 22 owls all wandered off, often making perilous journeys of more than 5 miles before finding suitable habitat. The findings are being warmly received by other ecologists. The idea of transplants has long created something of a quandary for experts in the field of ecology, said Dan Bloomstein, a professor at the University of California, Los Angeles, who was not involved in the study. "There's been this assumption that if endangered animals are just moved elsewhere, they're going to be fine, but that's clearly not always true," he said. "Experiments like this are essential for figuring out what works and what does not." Dr. Bloomstein said Dr. Swaysgood both hope to see transplants of other species studied in a similar way to ensure that scientists' good intentions are not resulting in unnecessary hardship for species that are already on the brink. Living in a bubble, did this failed 90s experiment predict the future? Written by Rosie Frost for the Environmental Desk at Euronews. In 1991, 8 people started a 2-year adventure that would see them quarantined inside a replica of Earth's ecosystem. It's a futuristic story straight out of the pages of a sci-fi bestseller that has been overlooked and discounted for its controversial collapse. The huge environmental experiment, considered a failure at the time, was conducted in a 3.14-acre vivarium in the Arizona desert. After the space race of the 70s and 80s, the possibility of traveling to Mars was in sight. When creating the project named Biosphere 2, scientists, engineers, and businessmen set out to solve the problems of extraterrestrial survival. Over 7 years, a collection of sealed domes and greenhouses were constructed in Arizona to recreate Earth on a smaller scale. The environment contained a 9,100-square-foot ocean with its own coral reef, a fog desert, a savanna grassland, a rainforest, and an agricultural system. The biospherians were expected to cultivate their own food and drink while also maintaining livable levels of carbon dioxide and oxygen, all with little outside help. Everything taken into Biosphere had to be screened for noxious gases that could put the inhabitants at risk. Even health and beauty products like deodorants were banned in order to prevent harmful substances from upsetting the ecosystem's delicate balance. But it didn't go as planned. Oxygen levels became dangerously low as the plant life couldn't keep up with carbon dioxide levels. Any oxygen produced was converted into CO2 and absorbed by the unsealed concrete used to make the habitat. Animals and plants started to die at an alarming rate, and a lack of resources split the group into two warring factions. It drew attention in the press, and controversy followed with criticism of the project's charismatic counterculture inventor, John Allen. An article in the environmental journal Ecology called the experiment, quote, New Age drivel masquerading as science, and ecologists discounted their findings for lack of peer review. Those who took part in Biosphere 2 re-entered mainstream society with a completely new perspective. In 2018, scientist Mark Nelson explained that coming back to a world with extensive rubbish piles and pollution, where he couldn't see how his food was produced, was, quote, strangely disorientating. Being a part of the experiment made him more aware of how delicate an ecosystem can be. Everything we did had consequences and greatly increased our mindfulness, he said in a piece for the Dartford Alumni Gazette. He revealed that the crew of eight learned a lot about keeping stressed coral reefs alive, protecting the rainforest, and working with the environment to reduce CO2 levels. Spaceship Earth is a documentary released in 2020 that chronicles the story of Biosphere 2. For director Matt Wolf, learning the project's history made him realize it was really a story about the entire world. They didn't fail because of their unrealistic ambition, he said in a statement to the press, but rather because it was started with profit as a goal. Premiered at the Sundance Film Festival, the film's launch coincided with a similar experiment being unwittingly conducted on a global scale, the COVID-19 pandemic. I could never have imagined that a pandemic would require the entire world to be quarantined, said Wolf. Like today, the biospherians lived confined inside and managed day-to-day life with limited resources, often under great interpersonal stress. But when they re-entered the world, they were forever transformed. No longer would they take anything for granted, not even a breath. In light of COVID-19, we're all living like biospherians. And we too will re-enter a new world. The question is, how will we be transformed? Thank you for joining us for the Environment Program. This is Karen Wheeler.